This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Reports out of Iraq paint a bleak picture. Today, two major contractors, Siemens and GE, shut down all or part of their operations because of security concerns. Yesterday, car bombs killed scores of Iraqis, including many schoolchildren, in the southern city of Basra, which had been relatively quiet. Standoffs between American troops and insurgents continue in Fallujah and Najaf, and travel on at least some roads in Iraq has become impossible. In recent days, dozens of foreigners have been kidnapped. Most have been freed, but the prospect adds to the uncertainty and fear. To try to get a sense of day-to-day life for contractors, NGOs, for the military, and of course for Iraqis, we're going to speak with people in or just back from several Iraqi cities. If you have questions about what's happening there and how people are coping with the situation, our number in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. And let's begin with our own Ann Garrels in Baghdad. Annie, always good to have you on the show.
Great to talk to you.
How is life functioning in Baghdad amidst this upsurge of violence in the past few weeks?
Well, you know, in many ways, life seems normal here for Iraqis. But on the other hand, they're always scared that there's going to be a car bomb, that something is going to happen, that American troops will then react, that checkpoints will be put up. It's, you know, life for a year for them has been difficult, and it's just more difficult now.
What about the situation on the roads? Are both military and civilian supplies able to pass freely throughout the country and get into places like Baghdad?
Neil, it's a really mixed picture. Initially, the U.S.-led occupation administration announced that they were closing basically two key thoroughfares from the north and partially in the north and in the south, especially the road coming from Kuwait. The road to the west of Jordan is basically shut because of the standoff in Fallujah, which that road goes straight through Fallujah and Ramadi, and there have been several attacks there. So the transport coming from Jordan is all but stopped. As it turns out, though, the roads in the north and the south aren't closed. They're fixing some things. They're temporarily maybe shut, but it is disrupting transportation. So far, Iraqis aren't complaining that much about supplies. I know I heard the sound cut you had from the pharmacist talking about medicines. We're not seeing drastic shortages yet. The people who are being hurt are the military and the occupation administration. I mean, there are about 11,000 people who live in basically an armed compound, and they depend completely on supplies. I mean, everything from toilet paper, Kleenex, and all of their food to come from Kuwait. They don't eat or use local products, which makes Iraqis furious. They get it all from the south. Well, that road is very dangerous. There have been a lot of attacks, and especially on what are clearly foreign convoys. So they've lost their ketchup and their mustard and have been reduced to only one hot dog and no seconds of ice cream. But Iraqis have yet to really feel the pinch, although they may well as time goes on.
Are those roads closed, as you mentioned, attacks particularly on what look to be military supply convoys? But there's also bridges that have been blown up?
Yes. What I was told was that down in the south, there's one key bridge that was blown up. And what the insurgents were doing, military officials told me that they had shown a new expertise and coordination that they had not seen before, that they were monitoring the convoys and in advance radioing on ahead and saying the convoy was coming. They would blow up a bridge or set off some kind of a roadside bomb, forcing the convoys to make a detour where they would be even more vulnerable to attack. And so certainly the roads have to be fixed and some bridges, because the traffic can move on them, but not convoys, not heavy trucks.
What can you tell us about the two standoffs that are continuing? I guess you mentioned earlier the one in Fallujah, where an uneasy ceasefire seems to, I guess, still be holding?
Well, it's holding, but It's very dicey. The senior U.S. negotiator has just gone back down there tonight. I spoke to the Iraqi negotiators. They're following quickly on their way. The big problem is that part of the ceasefire deal is that the civic leaders promised that the insurgents would turn over their heavy weapons. So far, the Marines and U.S. officials say what's been turned over is A, very little, and what has been turned over, as they put it, is nothing but trash and junk, not the weapons they're using to fight off the Marines. So they've said that this ceasefire will last no more than days, certainly not weeks, just a few days, and the civic leaders have got to deliver. They've always been, as well-meaning as the civic leaders may be, they've always suspected that they're not going to be able to deliver on the insurgents and get them to turn over these weapons.
We'll be speaking with a reporter in Najaf a little bit later in the program to find out what's been going on there, where the situation, again, American troops outside the city trying to negotiate through intermediaries with Muqtada al-Sadr, the young Shiite cleric who's been at odds, to say the least, with the U.S. occupation forces. But what about the situation in Basra yesterday? That had been relatively quiet until those car bombs at police stations.
And not just car bombs, but a remarkably coordinated series of almost simultaneous car bombs, which have killed now over the death toll is rising. It's now over 70. As U.S. officials say here, and I think they're right, whoever is doing this, there are a few days of quiet, and then they do something spectacular like this. So everyone in Iraq is uneasy, off guard, not knowing, where and when it's going to happen next. The interesting thing is that people here generally don't blame the insurgents. They tend to blame the Americans at this point. There's a serious problem that's emerged over the past year. It was evident in the immediately, but is worse now. The gap between expectations of many Iraqis and the inability of the occupation authority to improve conditions, living with American soldiers on the streets, they run roughshod pretty much over people. There's a lot of resentment now to the Americans.
Beyond the security situation, which is obviously unsettled, some of those services that the people were expecting were certainly in the early days, we kept hearing all the time about electricity, about water. How are all those kinds of services functioning these days?
Not as well as certainly people expected. The great American superpower, why can't they deliver? I mean, of course, the contractors have been under attack since the very beginning. It's merely gotten worse in the last month, but this is not an entirely new phenomenon. Electricity in Baghdad, for instance, is now 2 hours on, 4 hours off. And as we approach, it's getting pretty steamy here right now, and most people can't afford generators, and it's going to be another very hot summer. And you go to places like Sadr City, where several million live, the Shiite slums basically of Baghdad, and it's a trash heap. And most of Baghdad doesn't look great. Under Saddam, it wasn't a charming city, but it was clean. It is far from that now.
Well, let's get some listeners involved in the conversation. Our number is 800-989-8255. Our email address is totn@npr.org. And we'll talk with George, who's with us from Fairfax, California.
Hi, Neil. Thanks for accepting my question.
Sure.
It's a two-parter. The first part is I was curious if the civilian contractors have military counterparts who are remaining in Iraq and can continue some of the services. The second part is, I was curious if any of the civilian contractors are able to protect themselves by either being armed or through some other means.
Most of the civilian contractors, are engineers, or many of the people who have been killed or kidnapped in the last few, have just been drivers. They have no military training to defend themselves. And so they are usually accompanied by security companies, which is and these security companies have, let me just, you're getting interference.
Uh-huh.
Because phones are ringing. Sorry.
That's all right.
I'm in an office. But the contractors have security companies working for them. And one of the big problems now is if they are going to do their jobs, they're going to have even more security. And that security is going to drain off a huge amount of the $18 billion, which is supposed to go to reconstruction. That money is going to, a lot of it is going to go to paying for guards. And the military can't do the jobs themselves. The military is already stretched now dramatically in terms of dealing with, security. So while there is the Army Corps of Engineers and while they have done a lot in the past, increasingly the troops who are here now are military. They're not to do sort of the extras, the contractors like Bechtel, Siemens, General Electric, and Iraqis are doing a lot of the work. But they need supplies and they need parts. They need and all of those need to be coming in on those convoys, and those convoys aren't moving as fast as they should be.
And obviously the departure of at least some of the employees from places like GE and Siemens is not going to make the job of restoration of water and electricity any easier.
No, not at all. The Minister of Electricity said that, there are very good Iraqi technicians, and they can do it, and they're going to their jobs. The problem, though, is that, ironically, even though these guys are providing, the very things that the Iraqis want, they are also being targeted. People who are seen to be working with the coalition authorities or the occupation administration are being hit.
Mm-hmm. Thanks very much for the question, George. Let's go now to, we're going to try to get to Alan, and Alan's calling from Binghamton, New York.
Yes, hello. Thanks for taking the call.
Sure.
I just want to say that this conversation kind of mirrors the conversation that you had earlier about the photographs and why we weren't getting some of the images that the rest of the world is seeing, in that what we are getting is, oh, those poor civilian contractors, oh, those poor troops who aren't getting their ketchup and mustard and hot dogs. Well, what about Ali, who had his arms blown off and the rest of his family blown away as he was sleeping in bed? He'll never draw a picture again, okay? Why aren't we, but that's just collateral damage. Okay, this is a group of people who have invaded illegally another country, okay? By the way, Iraqi has more PhDs per capita than America. They can quite capably handle themselves. Let's also not think that these are isolated upticks in violence, okay? These people are fighting for their lives, okay? And I want to know, Neil, I want to know from you, when are you going to have a program without RAND Corporation think tank flunkies, without other military individuals telling us what to think about how we're wonderfully going about blowing up people and the U.S. is never having to face why their SUVs are responsible for invading other countries? And I want to know, when are we going to have a real discussion about getting George Bush, Dick Cheney, Paul Wolfowitz, and Donald Rumsfeld into an international criminal court, because these people are war criminals, even by the lightest legal standards?
That would be today, at least for the first part of your question, Alan. Annie, you're there in Baghdad. We just have a few seconds left in this segment, but how accurate is that description?
The situation here is extremely complicated. You know, after a long, dictatorship of Saddam, people are unable to fix it themselves, but they also resent having to have people from the outside. It's not easy to parse. And the contractors have tried to do a good job for Iraqis, but they have been attacked.
Anne Garrels in Baghdad. We'll be more back with more from her, and we'll be speaking with reporters in Najaf and Sulaymaniyah as well, and talking about other parts of Iraq after a break. This is NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. After a year of occupation, the situation in Iraq has become extremely dangerous for foreigners and Iraqis alike. Soldiers are perpetual targets. Now, contract workers and workers and even journalists covering the story have trouble moving around the country, and the situation for Iraqis has always been dangerous over the past years. If you have questions about the situation there, give us a phone call. Our number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. The email address is totn@npr.org. Our guest is NPR's Ann Garrels, who's on the line with us from Baghdad. We're also speaking to some other people who are in or have recently returned to other parts of Iraq to try to get a picture outside of Baghdad as well. Bob Fittis is Country Director for Relief International, one of the humanitarian organizations that have played a key role in post-war Iraq. Relief International is helping to reconstruct damaged buildings. And Bob Fittis spent the last 10 months in Amara, which is on the Tigris River in southeastern Iraq. Today he's home on leave in Seattle, Washington. Good to have you on Talk of the Nation.
Thank you, Neil.
How much of your staff is operating in Iraq right now?
We currently have 37 Iraqis working in Amara.
And how many foreigners, Americans?
None. The three expats, I being one of them, left Mason in the latter part of March.
And was that because of rotation or because of the security situation?
In my case, it was because of rotation. For my two Indian colleagues, it was because of the security situation.
And is the work that you were doing there in reconstructing buildings, is that able to continue?
Yeah, I'm happy to report that we have about $1.75 million of work continuing with our Iraqi staff.
And what is the situation there like? As you say, it's obviously dangerous for foreigners, but describe for us what life in Amara was like just before you left.
Before I left, it was peaceful. I could go to the souk or the market and get a haircut and not feel threatened. I could walk on the streets and be greeted by both people I've known and met in the last 10 months and by people that were aware that I was there helping rebuild, and really could move about without any fear.
And what changed?
Well, there's a couple towns called Fallujah and Najaf and the Al-Sadr people that just basically turned the situation ugly.
And were there Muqtada al-Sadr's militia, the Mahdi army, were they there in Amara?
Yes, they actually have a fairly good stronghold in Amara. Amara is basically the center of an agrarian society. We have a high level of unemployment there, and they tend to attract their followers from the lesser educated and the unemployed, so they're quite able to attract a large following in Amara.
From what you're able to tell, I assume you're still in contract with your Iraqi employees there. Who's in control in Amara now?
Good question. The CPA is there. There's really an entirely different scenario with the British in charge in the south as opposed to the Americans in charge in the north. I think that's part of the reason the south has stayed so peaceful in the last 10 months since I've been there. Now, 2 days ago in Basra, that situation turned around entirely.
Mm-hmm.
During the day, I think from what I gathered in talking to my chief engineer last night in Amara, things are relatively safe. In the evening, however, there are bombs going off, there are firefights, and things are not safe in the evenings.
Do you think it's too dangerous for you to go back now?
For me to go back tomorrow, yes, I would consider it way too dangerous to go back. I am always concerned about the safety of my Iraqi staff, and they assure me that they're not in harm's way in any way at this point.
Bob Fittis, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you.
Bob Fittis joined us from his home in Seattle, Washington. He spent the better part of the last year with Relief International helping with reconstruction in Amara in Iraq. Let's get another caller on the line. This is David, who's with us from Spinnerstown, Pennsylvania.
Yes, good afternoon. Who am I speaking with, please?
I'm Neil Conan.
Neil, good to speak with you. I served in the an Army Reserve Military Police Unit. I just recently got back from Iraq. I was in the Nasiriyah area in the south, and I was also in a number of different places inside and around the area of Baghdad. Two things I basically wanted to say. One is, from having been back just a couple of weeks, it seems as though NPR is about the only network that seems to be at least making an attempt to provide what I would call fair coverage of what's going on there. I think one of the difficulties becomes that the stuff, when things go boom, that draws attention.
Mm-hmm.
We did get shot at. I do know what it's like to hear mortar rounds and rocket fire in my immediate direction. I wasn't in some quiet little alcove someplace. However, so much of what I did see convinced me and a large number of the soldiers with whom I served, and we're talking folks who did service on convoys, supply convoys, that got shot at, got hit by IEDs.
The improvised explosive devices.
Yes, I was about to clarify. Improvised explosive devices. We had the opportunity to see an awful lot of good things done, bringing supplies to hospitals, orphanages, schools in local communities, soldiers in one area of Baghdad where I worked. We had things that were sent from home. Schools, civic organizations, churches would send all kinds of supplies over. And we would go into the cities, to orphanages, hospitals, schools, daycare centers, community centers, and have the chance basically to meet with the people, work with the people, get to know the people.
And let's, Ann Garrell, so you've reported on some of those activities as well. It is not just one picture, is it?
Absolutely. I couldn't agree more with the caller. The problem that's happened as a result of Fallujah, though, is that, you know, that many Iraqis see the siege of the city. They see the what they perceive to be Americans punishing 300,000 people for the killing of four American private contractors. And it has galvanized many in the population who before were at least neutral about the occupation. It's and as I've said before, there is something that is very hard for us to deal with, the gap between expectations of many Iraqis and the ability of the occupation administration to meet those expectations. And even though more and more Iraqis tend to blame the Americans for everything that goes wrong, rather than blaming themselves.
David?
It's a reality.
I think that is basically, from my observations, fair. When we had a chance to talk with the Iraqis, a lot of times they did kind of expect us, and I understand the perception, we're the most powerful nation on the face of the earth. I have seen a somewhat humorous story, but it helps to illustrate the point. We were bringing supplies to a local village. We had a 2.5-ton truck. I remember a boy of about 9 or 10 coming up and making requests of me and other soldiers for certain things. And it was obvious that in this child's mind, Macy's department store had just rolled up, and like the magician's magic hat, everything was in the back of that truck. And this little boy was very disappointed when he asked me for a soccer ball. We just, at that point in time, didn't happen to have one. I'm not saying that the whole nation is expecting us to be magicians, but I certainly agree with what Ann Garrell has said, that the expectations have sometimes been, this is the greatest, most powerful nation in the world. They must be able to make everything happen immediately and quickly. And one of the things that we all who have been there recognize, that especially when you are in situations where supplies are hard to get and where things take time and trucks break down, a lot of things don't happen as quickly as expectations would have them occur.
David, thanks very much. We appreciate it.
Thank you very much for allowing me to speak.
Okay.
Have a good day, sir.
Bye-bye. While violence and instability are a daily part of life in many areas of Iraq, the northern parts of the country are different. Sulaymaniyah is a city in Iraqi Kurdistan, a region that's been beyond Baghdad's control for years. The situation there is calm and quiet. For example, tomorrow is picnic day in Sulaymaniyah. Maggie Zanger is currently training local journalists in Iraqi Kurdistan. She's with the Institute for War and Peace Reporting. She joined us on the phone from Sulaymaniyah. Thanks very much for staying up to speak with us.
Hi, thank you.
Picnic day sounds like a distant dream for much of Iraq.
Oh, it certainly is. I can't tell you how happy I am to be up here, to be able to participate. Every Friday, once spring begins, every Friday is picnic day. Thousands of people pour out of the cities of Iraqi Kurdistan and go into the mountains, into the open fields, the hillsides. They fix food, they hang out all day, they dance, they sing, they play music, they drink beer. They just enjoy the out-of-doors, and this is something that, unfortunately, is just impossible in the rest of Iraq.
Are people there aware of what's going on in the rest of the country?
They are aware, and they're concerned about it. They would like to see the rest of the country as stable and as prosperous as they are. But they also see it as distant. It's distant violence, the way you might see it from the United States. They see it on television. It really doesn't affect them directly in almost any way. They're concerned about it, but they're not directly impacted. They look at it from a distance.
Why is it, do you think, that Kurdistan is so different from the rest of the country?
Oh, there's a million reasons. Culturally, the Kurds are different from the Arabs. Politically, they have been, for all intents and purposes, they've been independent for the past 12 years. They have their own functioning government. The government is on their side. They elected people into office. There's electricity, there's water. The Kurds are running their own schools, health services. They've really been in control of their own agenda for the past 12 years. And this continues, of course, today. They have a very well-functioning intelligence service. They have their own police. They have their own army. So culturally, they're different. Politically, they're different. Also up here, the neighboring countries aren't able to interfere like they're interfering in the south. Iran's interference in the south politically, and in many ways Syria interfering in the central parts of the country. Again, because they have their own intelligence services, their own police, they're able to control this. And politically, they're much stronger and they're much more cohesive than the rest of the country. The rest of the country, unfortunately, is still very confused. The Kurds have been self-ruling for quite a few years, and they're just much more stable.
It's not to say
much more settled than the rest of the country.
Not to say the Kurds themselves did not have a few years of enormous difficulties in the early times, including some civil war.
Oh, exactly. No, they had horrendous times, and that's why they looked to center south, and they say, you know, the Kurds did go through this whole sorting out. They had a wonderful election. They elected a parliament. They had a united government, and it all broke down. And this is what they expect to happen in the rest of Kurdistan, or in the rest of Iraq. It takes a while for the politics to sort themselves out, for leadership to emerge, for vying political powers to kind of sort themselves out and settle. It's been quite calm. These two Kurdish governments seem to function quite well in a kind of cold peace for the past, since 1998. They definitely went through their own difficulties, and that's why they're not surprised at all to see this happening in the central and southern parts of the country. It's not surprising at all.
Maggie Zanger, thanks very much, and have a great time on picnic day.
Thank you, I will.
Maggie Zanger, training director in Iraq for the Institute for War and Peace Reporting. She was with us by phone from Sulaymaniyah in Iraqi Kurdistan. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And we're going to keep Ann Garrels with us, but we want to go now to... we were going to go to Najaf, but we just lost the phone line to Najaf. So, Ann Garrels, if you're still there?
I am, okay. I am.
Ann, thanks very much. Let's get another caller on the line for you. Let's talk with Nick, who's with us from Allentown, Pennsylvania.
Yes, hello.
Hi.
Hi, Neil. And Ann, I appreciate everything you're doing. You're a great reporter. I have two questions. You can answer either one. You're on the ground there, and do you get the feeling from the Sunnis and the Shiites that you speak to that they would, since they're a bit united now against the U.S., if the coalition forces were to diminish or get rearranged in some way so that the U.S. president was less noticeable, do you get the impression that they are willing to work together and put aside their past disputes to create their nation again? Or would they, you know, resort back to the way they were and start, you know, their own civil war with among themselves? But they seem united, so maybe that's a good step.
They're not entirely united, although certain segments of the population, certainly the poorest and the segments, have united on the issues of Fallujah. That has been a galvanizing issue for many Iraqis who see the U.S. as a real aggressor in that case, and many who are frustrated with the lack of development in general. But at this point, the political situation here is so uncertain. I think you can't really talk about unity. We're going into a transition phase when you hand over political sovereignty at the end of June. We still don't even know what kind of government that will be, that caretaker government. Ibrahim Brahimi has come up with a solution that would seem to be one that, while not acceptable to everybody, is probably the only possible solution at this point, which will be a prime minister, a president, and two vice presidents that'll go through until January, when real elections can finally be held. But there's a real question. Okay, who's going to be the prime minister? The Shiites are saying we're 60%, and for all of this talk of unity between Sunnis and Shia, you know, they still want the next government to reflect their numbers, which never happened under Saddam. So there are still a lot of fights to be fought. And now, one thing I wanted to mention after I heard the report from Sulaymaniyah, there's another critical issue being done here. There is a military unit, for instance, an Iraqi military unit that the U.S. has drawn into the battle in Fallujah. And included in that group are some Kurdish fighters, the Peshmerga, who are by far the most loyal to the United States. And they, as she pointed out, after 12 years of autonomy, they have a very good military. And the Americans have been using the Kurdish Peshmerga there, as well as some other Iraqis. And this is causing a huge problem. Many Iraqis are now looking at the Kurds as the U.S. That they're doing the U.S. bidding and are fighting the Iraqi Arabs. And many, even some of the Iraqi negotiators in the process in Fallujah, have raised this as a serious issue and said to the U.S., get those Kurds out of there. This is going to create huge political problems down the road.
Nick, thanks very much for the call.
Thank you. You'd answered a lot of my questions.
Okay, appreciate it. And Annie, hang with us, because when we try to come back from the break, we're going to get through to Najaf, we hope.
You're going to get through to Najaf.
We're one way or another, we're going to get through to Najaf. So hang there with us. We're also going to be talking about, after we return from the break, Ohio's part in World War II's Battle of the Atlantic. So stay with us. I'm Neil Conan. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. And Ann Garrels is with us, NPR's correspondent in Baghdad. And joining us now from the city of Najaf, south of Baghdad, is Dan Murphy, correspondent with the Christian Science Monitor. And we appreciate you staying up and fighting all the phone problems with us, Dan.
My pleasure.
How was the journey from Baghdad to Najaf?
Surprisingly easy. It's about a two-hour drive, maybe a little longer, and we really zipped down this morning. I'd spent a couple of days setting up letters of safe passage with the Mahdi army, that's of course loyal to Muqtadir al-Sadr, in case we ran into any problems. And as it happened, we didn't get stopped once, didn't need to flash the paper, and we also didn't go through any U.S. military checkpoints.
The situation we hear being described in Najaf is that the city is still under the control of Muqtadir al-Sadr's forces, U.S. army massed outside of the city, things very tense. Is that accurate?
Certainly his people are still in control of the city, and you do driving in, particularly in Kufa, which is just on the outskirts of town where he gives his Friday sermons, and it's a sort of bastion of support around here, there were truckloads of men with rocket-propelled grenades and Kalashnikovs zooming all over the place, and these are his militia men. And here in Najaf, where there's a key shrine of Ali, which is probably the holiest site in Shiite Islam, he has armed men spread throughout the worn-like alleys around that key shrine, and there are no police and there are no security forces of any sort. However, the U.S. that was massed a good distance outside the city has begun to pull back even further, because I think they've realized that if they were to come into this place and open fire in the city, they could end up pushing a lot more support towards al-Sadr, and the way they're dealing with him now is to simply hopefully his support attrits away over time.
What sort of attitudes towards al-Sadr is there inside Najaf?
If you talk to Najaf shopkeepers and people that aren't particularly political, and it's hard to say for certain, but you get the impression that the vast majority of Najaf's residents are fed up with the trouble he's brought to the city. Millions of pilgrims come here in a year, and so there's a lot of people whose businesses depend on it. And for the past 2 or 3 weeks, the flow of pilgrims, both Iraqi and Iranian, into the shrine has slowed to a trickle, which is hurting everybody's business. They're not letting their kids go to school because they're afraid. And while, like most Iraqis, they're very, very ambivalent and uncomfortable with the U.S. occupation, there were never any U.S. troops There were never any U.S. troops based in this city, so they weren't confronted with that on a daily basis. But now they're confronted with the Mahdi army, so they're quite upset and angry.
How does Najaf strike you? I know you just arrived there today, but you've been there before. How is it different?
Well, it's a lot quieter. The last time I was here in the areas around the shrine, which are now cut off from vehicular traffic for at least a quarter of a mile in every direction because of a terrible car bombing here last August, there's a press of people from lots of countries. There are people hawking stuff by the sides of the road in a typical day here. Now all the push carts are gone, and the streets feel quite deserted.
Dan Murphy, thanks very much. We really appreciate it.
My pleasure.
Dan Murphy, a correspondent with the Christian Science Monitor, with us from Najaf, due south of Baghdad, on the Euphrates River. And Ann Garrels, before we let you go, obviously your reporters are not supposed to be part of the story, but Dan was describing getting pass papers from the Mahdi army. Most of the datelines we see covering Iraq today are either from Fallujah or Baghdad. Because of the situations on the roads and the fear of kidnapping, are reporters more or less tied up in Baghdad?
For the most part, yes. I mean, it's as we just heard on the road in Najaf, it's capricious. You know, he was very lucky. I went down to Kerbala recently. I had no trouble, too. Yet, you know, a day or two later, you know, foreigners were taken hostage on that very same road. You just don't know. And so a lot of people are staying in Baghdad. We can move around Baghdad. But everybody moves in different ways, I have to say. Television companies, you know, they go in very noticeable convoys. They drive in SUVs. Other journalists tend to just drive around in normal, clapped-out Iraqi cars. They're far less noticeable. Some companies have security guards, which makes them, in fact, even more noticeable. Other journalists don't. We all work in very different ways. The people who are out of Baghdad, a lot of them are at the moment embedded with the American troops.
Ann Garrels, as always, thank you so much, and take care of yourself, will you?
Absolutely. Thank you.
NPR's Ann Garrels on the satellite telephone with us from Baghdad.